U.S. shouldn't touch the Middle East and let those people make their own decisions. Forget about Israel. It's a colonial project. Forget about U.S. bases in the Middle East. Let the people decide for themselves.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
With Shai Davidi.
This season of Here I Am with Shai Davidi is dedicated to the memory of my grandmother, Savta Leah Davidi, who passed away earlier this year. Here I am with Savta Leah in mind.
Before I begin, I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters who are not only supporting us in making this podcast, but are also watching this live as we're recording this. So my guest today has been the executive director of the Middle East Forum for the past 10 years. He served in the Israeli Foreign Ministry and Defense Ministry and is considered one of the main or great experts on Middle East and U.S. interest in the Middle East. Here I am with Greg Roman.
Thank you very much.
Greg, thank you so much for coming here, and we really hope to delve as deeply as possible into understanding the Middle East. I think a lot of people care and are worried that they might not have all the information and are worried that if they don't have the information, that they aren't able to speak about it. And we want to arm them with as much information as possible. But before we do, I want to ask you the first question I ask every guest, which is, Greg Roman, what kind of a Jew are you?
I think I am one that is proud of his Jewish identity, but I am one who chose, by virtue of his parents and loco parentis, when he was 7 days old, being adopted and born in a hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, then making my way, I say by the cutoff date, on the eighth day to my Brit Milah.
Literal cutoff date.
Quite literally. And then also my sister, 3.5 years later, same situation, different birth family, also being adopted from Kentucky. So I'm not just someone who has chosen to be very proud of my Jewish identity and my Jewish peoplehood, but I was chosen by a Jewish family to be raised that way. And I think I've really embraced that through every step of either my personal growth as a child into a teenager and then into a young adult, but also my professional capacity. A lot of the work that I do today is motivated by not just my love of being an American, but also my love of being Jewish. And I've seen that, I think, in my own way over the past 40 years. I just turned 40 last month, so a lot to reflect on. But we raise our kids Jewish. They go to a Jewish day school. We're very connected with our Ahavat Yisrael, our love of Israel. And we're actually planning to spend a year now in Israel, going to Hod HaSharon, where we'll be living starting from July. So it's not just something you wear on your sleeve. You know, somebody told me, what's the difference between the Islam version of monotheism and the Christian version of monotheism and Judaism and it being a monotheistic religion? If you're a Muslim or you're a Christian, you believe in one God. That's the essence of your religion. But Judaism asks for something more. You have to be an ethical monotheist. You have to work and act upon your belief in one God. And that idea is that if you think there's something that God gave you, whether it's the state of Israel, your life, your identity, the opportunity that comes with everything wonderful that is in this world, you have to act to earn it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's part of my MO as it relates to what I do on day-to-day work, but also what I do in my private life.
So, you know, just to understand a bit better, what is the acting for you?
Sure.
How do you enact your Jewish identity on a day-to-day basis?
So I think a lot of it has to do with the politics of the day and making sure that you never get divided into one tribe besides the tribe of the Jewish people, mm-hmm. right? You have people who are on the right, people who are on the left, identity politics, people who try to force you into a corner to identify, what are you? What is it exactly that you're trying to be? Who is it that you're trying to embolden? What is it that you believe in? You can answer all those questions, but what you may believe one day as a Jew, which is good for the Jewish people or good for the United States or good for the state of Israel, might be different the next day. You have to be able to call balls and strikes. And it's the same thing like you would have in comparison to 2,000 years ago, a Talmudic debate. What might be the answer and relevant during the Roman times might change when the Byzantines come. where it might change when Nazi Europe rises, where it might change when the United States in a decision in 1945 gives Jews the opportunities to buy all houses in the United States and not just be put into a certain neighborhood. So I think the way that I express my Jewish identity is being able to embrace the change and being able to align it with Jewish values, but also making sure that those are equal with my values as an American. So I think the two are very much one and the same. There's a great book that just came out. And I forget the title, but I'll give it to you to send to your listeners, which is about Jewish involvement with the birth of the United States all the way through today. But it really focuses on the revolution. Chaim Salomon was the financier of the American Revolution. He died in poverty, but he gave his entire wealth to the founding of the country. The armorers of the American Revolution, people gave us the weapons and the gunpowder to be able to fight the British, were all connected with Jewish traitors. Those people who helped with the ideas of the Constitution weren't Jewish. But there was even a debate where Jefferson said, we have to distance ourselves from the English as much as possible. Let's have Hebrew as the national language of the United States of America. And I think there's a real story there to be told of not just the Christian identity of how the United States was came to be, but the Judeo-Christian part of it. And I think that in the work that I do with our organization's mission for the Middle East Forum of promoting American interests in the Middle East, it lines up one-to-one. You know, being able to see what Jewish interests are.
It's very interesting that you bring that up, because one of the things that I kept hearing from the moment I moved to the U.S. 15 years ago was about the Judeo-Christian values. And it's never the Christian values, never the Judeo, but the Judeo-Christian values. What is the overlap there? For someone from the outside, you know, I hear it a lot. People say Jewish values are American values are Jewish values. What are those values? What's the overlap?
So, I mean, we can go into a 3-hour conversation on this, just on probably the First Amendment, right? The right to speak freely, but then the right to assemble, the right to do things that really came out of Tanakhic thought. I mean, if you look at the 613 commandments, many of the original laws of the United States and what we thought to be the division between state and religion, religion gives you the ethics that you have your state morals based upon, and state gives you the structure to protect your religion. So if you're thinking about Judeo-Christian values insofar as it relates to how the Jewish identity helped start the United States, there's been Jews involved with American greatness and manifest destiny. And some of the bad stuff too. It's not just all good. I mean, if you think about it, the vice president and the secretary of war of the Confederacy were both Jewish. So we don't always necessarily pick the right horse to win with. But then on the other hand, some of Lincoln's most closest advisors were also Jewish. So in terms of the essence of what it means to be Jewish and to be American or to embrace Judeo-Christian values, I think it really comes from the point that America was set up to be the defender of all peoples who embrace what we stand for, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. But Jews have done their part too, making sure that people can embrace their life, elongate it through medicine, that they can have liberty, that we have some of the best lawyers and some of the best practitioners of law, members of Congress, those who act in a parliamentary fashion to be able to enunciate those values, write them into a law, and give the Americans the experience that they deserve, and also the pursuit of happiness. I mean, you may look at it from the point of view where they say, oh, there's a lot of Jews who are involved in entertainment. There's a lot of Jews who are involved in writing and literary works and university and college and education. We try to find ourselves to be our best selves in whatever pursuit that it is that we try to embrace. But it's not just doing it for our selfish reasons. Yeah, we do it because we want to be able to make our lives better in America. But I think many Jews are involved in these pursuits because they want to make America better. And that's really the intersection of the two. It's not just the religious element. It's what comes with the Jewish people being part of the greater American project.
And I think you try to do that with your work. The Middle East Forum. So what is the Middle East Forum?
So the Middle East Forum is a research center that was set up in 1994 by Daniel Pipes, one of the most preeminent Middle East analysts, experts, doctorate from Harvard, spent many of his younger years in Turkey and Egypt learning Arabic, learning Middle Eastern languages. But he grew up in a house with a man named Richard Pipes, who is was known as one of the preeminent Sovietologists, those who study the Soviet Union, actually himself leaving Poland before the start of World War II, finding himself in the U.S. Army, working with the Pentagon, working with U.S. Army intelligence, going to Harvard and having an illustrious 60-year career as a professor there. And he was actually an individual, Daniel's father, who was responsible for Russia policy in the Reagan administration. And Daniel was not working with him, but working alongside him, the State Department for Policy Planning, which is the place where the U.S. Conceives its foreign policy. For about 10 years, Daniel was involved with private ventures, with public ventures and public service. But in 94, he saw that after the Gulf War, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the Middle East was going to be the next big theater that the U.S. was going to have to be concerned about. Of course, he was concerned in the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War, but there was never any real direct action until the U.S. Marine intervention in Beirut in the early 80s, and then the bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks, and then the Gulf War in 91. So he set up this center to be able to be the most central place for Middle East policy and thinking. And he sought it out to be the place where if a policymaker on Capitol Hill or in the executive branch or even just general laymen wanted to get a better understanding of the Middle East Forum is where they would come to convene. So we hosted the president of Algeria, politicians from Middle Eastern countries. But it really came to the forefront when Daniel in 1997 and 1998 identified Al-Qaeda as one of the biggest threats to American national security concerns. Then came the embassy bombings, then the bombing of the USS Cole, and unfortunately 9/11. Overnight, he was on TV 100, 150 times between 9/11 and then the following the next year. And then the organization took a shift where it realized that it's not just enough to talk about the Middle East, to analyze the Middle East. We have to do something about it. We have to take the information available at our analysts' hands and find a way to operationalize it. So in 2002, we started a project called Campus Watch, which looked at the viewpoints of Middle East and Islamic studies professors at places like Columbia. Rashid Khalidi is one of our biggest fans. Now, someone who has called us to be the next McCarthyite institution. But in fact, what we were doing was looking at his rhetoric, looking at his writing, looking at other professors like him and saying, you know what? This might be anathema to American national security interests in the region. This guy should be called out. And then it moved from campus over to nonviolent Islamists, those who don't seek to engage in violent attacks, but those who inspire them. The idea that the jihadis get the headlines, but the nonviolent Islamists, they get the results. They're able to bring their view of the Sharia, of Islamic law, not all Islamic law, but the way they see it, and sort of inculcate the population in terms of steering more towards their viewpoints. And then over the next 10, 15 years, up until today in 2025, we focused on areas of American life and American foreign policy overseas where there's a threat coming from a Middle East idea or a Middle Eastern state. So if it's dealing with Qatari excess in the United States, we've been focused on them as an institution for the last 15 years. It's only really gotten to the forefront once people really realize how pernicious the Qataris are as actors, anathema to American values. The Turks, who have been in a slowly degrading dictatorship for the past 23 years with the election of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The threat posed to the United States by Iran, not just from the nuclear program, not just from proxy actors, not just from their ballistic missiles program, but also from the influence that they're trying to exert here in the United States, whether it be on campus or sponsoring dozens of mosques through their version of the Jewish agency, Ahl Beit, which is responsible for spreading the revolution. So anywhere where there's a Middle Eastern issue which poses a potential concern to U.S. national security or U.S. allies, Israel, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, to a lesser extent, non-state allies like the Kurds, we're there to not just analyze what's happening, to predict what may happen, but also to find a way to weaponize the information that we have. And I don't want that to be a dirty word, to create some way to be able to fight back, but we believe that the best defense is a good offense. And that's what we do as an organization.
So I want to really take all of that 30-year almost real, like behind the scenes that you did there and really break that apart.
Sure.
So, but before that, I want to really understand the assumption that you started with, which is, you know, the shift from Soviet Russia being the center to now we need to deal with the Middle East.
Right.
Why is the Middle East looming so large in American foreign policy to begin with? You know, it really is a small region. If you think about all the African states, if you think of all the Southeast Asian states, why the Middle East?
So as much as this was a thought that came to Daniel in 94 when he started the Middle East Forum, it's been at the forefront of American policymaking since 1946. There was a War Department memo which was commissioned after World War II, where President Truman was asking the national security establishment at that time, what are the greatest threats to the United States and even Western security after the war is over, now that Nazism has been defeated? Of course, they said communism and the rise of the Soviet Union as one, but they also identified Islamism and Middle Eastern bad actors as number two. This is in 1946, the U.S. was thinking about this. In fact, if you look at the entire history, before even the Middle East Forum was founded, the U.S. has been intertwined in the Middle East because of three unique reasons. One is because of economy. The Middle East is the keystone of global energy security, whether it's dealing with oil, natural gas, anything dealing with the refinery, the refinement of that, and also the spreading of that. If you want to get from Saudi Arabia to Europe, you have to go along where the Houthis are now at. If you want to be able to go from the gas fields that are now off of Israel, you have to also transverse through the Suez Canal. And if you think of the actors that surround the Middle East, those from within are dangerous, but those who border are also dangerous. So if you want to disrupt global energy supplies, the Middle East is a great place to start. The second is because of the world religion. Number two in the world now, Islam. Islam was the fastest growing religion between 2010 and 2020. You had a billion Muslims in 2010. 347 million Muslims were born in that 10-year period. And frankly, the individuals coming from that area, when they proliferate and they go to other areas of the world, many of them come for a greater hope, but also some of them bring their ideology with them. And that's often at direct clash with some values that we hold in the West. Not all, but a significant minority. And thirdly, because just geographically, the Middle East is a keystone between Africa, Europe, and Asia. There's two huge projects now which are taking place. One sponsored by the Chinese, the other sponsored by Western countries. The Chinese program, the Belt and Road, aims to create a transcontinental economic and trade corridor which traverses the Middle East. Instead of having to put your goods on a ship and then go all the way from Shanghai and then make your way to Europe or the United States or wherever else, access to markets controlled by Chinese investments in infrastructure through all Uzbekistan, Iran, Pakistan, all the way through Turkey and then on its way to Europe, seeks to skip the center of the Middle East. It seeks to skip America's allies and to create a transportation corridor, which will be an artery for Chinese influence and economy in Europe. And also the other way with their sea projects, but that doesn't touch on the Middle East. The U.S.'s answer to that is IMEC, the India-Middle-East-Europe Corridor, which seeks from Mumbai, one of the most active ports in the world, to be able to take their goods to Dubai, put them on rail or on road or by pipeline to bring them across the Middle East into Israel and Egypt, and then ship them on their way to Europe. So if you just think of these two competing transportation arteries, you have geography being a major, major, major factor in the way that you make policy decision-making. Connecting those two great continents, Russia's out of the question. So the Middle East has become even more important today because of those realizations by Western economies that rely on a lot of the supplies from Southeast Asia.
And what does the average American not understand or maybe misunderstand about the Middle East? What are some common misconceptions?
There's two extreme polar opposites in American politics that agree on one thing, which is the U.S. shouldn't be involved in the Middle East. Think of those on the far left, those who are part of what we call the Red-Green Alliance, those who are Islamists or sympathize with Islamist regimes in the Middle East, or those people who are on the far left, those people who identify themselves as being closer to Maoists or even maybe DSA, you know, PFLP, Marxist-inspired folks. They say the U.S. shouldn't touch the Middle East and let those people make their own decisions. Forget about Israel. It's a colonial project. Forget about U.S. bases in the Middle East. Let the people decide for themselves. These are the guys who cheered on Mohamed Morsi when the Muslim Brotherhood was elected to rule Egypt back in 2012. And then on the other hand, you have the far right, those led by Tucker Carlson, those led by Candace Owens, those who are saying that the U.S. has to only focus on its interests. America first means only in America. We have to take back the entire U.S. force deployment that's over there. We have to make sure that any decisions we make respects the sovereignty of countries like Iran, who are trying to build a nuclear project to be able to threaten not just the U.S.'s allies, but the U.S. in general. Ignore the proxy attacks. Forget about Hamas. It's their problem. Let them worry about that. America shouldn't be involved. Because these two agree on the U.S. pulling out of the Middle East, everyday Americans who are very much in the middle listen to this side, they listen to that side. And then they have the rest of the buffer media, either from Fox News and the Washington Times and the National Review, or maybe the New York Times and the Washington Post and mainstream news media, whether it's CNN, MSNBC, or others. And they give audience sometimes to these people on these polar opposites. And their positions are pulled ahead. It's all the way over there. Why do I have to worry about it? But Lindsey Graham said it best when he had the 10-year review of the U.S.'s involvement in Afghanistan. This was conducted in 2011. And his conclusion was, problems over there often, more than not, become problems here. The U.S. may ignore the Middle East, but the Middle East is not ignoring the United States of America. And even when the U.S. has a minimal footprint there, like we had before the 80s, the Arab oil boycott hit us really hard. It was only because we were supporting an American ally there. Hundreds of Marines were killed because of the U.S. engaging in a peacekeeping force. So Graham finished the second part of that thought by saying the problems there become problems here, by saying it's better for us to deploy our assets and our resources and our firepower and our influence in the region so that it's cut off from being able to extend its influence and affect us here in the United States or allies in Europe, Southeast Asia, Africa, South America, and elsewhere.
So that's a great explanation for why the U.S. should care about the Middle East and the U.S. interest in the Middle East.
Right.
But what about the flip side of Graham's statement? Why does the Middle East care? You know, why do powers in the Middle East care about the right. United States? You don't have that with many Southeast Asian countries or African countries, but they care so deeply about what's happening here.
I think it's because the value proposition that a lot of America's enemies and those people who see the American way of life and the Western way of life writ large as being the exact opposite and animus to their beliefs. So if it's Al-Qaeda, for instance, Osama bin Laden's main grip with the U.S. was its presence in Saudi Arabia. That's what he was saying in the 90s. And then when he saw the U.S. increasing its influence throughout the Clinton administration and then into first Bush, he said, we have to strike at the heart of America because then they'll want to leave us alone. We ended up just doubling down on our presence and trying to eliminate him, which we succeeded in doing 11 years later, or maybe 9-10 years later. But the beliefs that are enunciated by non-state actors like Al-Qaeda are also held by state actors. Why is the U.S. the great Satan? It's because everything that the U.S. believes in is the exact opposite of what the mullahs want to be able to oppress their people on. When you have a country like the United States, which is a beacon of hope, not just for people wanting to come to the United States to immigrate here, to work here and live here, it's also a symbol of something that's better, where they may want to stay in their home country. They may want to be able to live in Iraq or Saudi or wherever else, but it's something that they can aspire to do. The American way of life. And I'm not just talking about consumerism. The way that we can sit here and talk and exchange ideas between each other without fear of government repression. The ability for us to write what we want, say what we want, to go where we want. Everything that Americans hold dear and sometimes take for granted is something that Middle East populations will only dream of having one day. And the people who hold them in their yoke of oppression are often those who are using the U.S. as a scapegoat to justify their actions against their own people. So even if the U.S. didn't have one soldier, one diplomat, one individual, you would still have Instagram, which would be proliferating ideas, and TikTok and anything else, and people would say, you know what? America's pretty good. Why can't we be more like them? And just the idea that we're the other makes us an enemy of these people who hold opinions and values and look at their way of life as being the complete polar opposite of what we hold dear and near as Americans.
Right. Although, wouldn't someone, you know, maybe not an apologist, but someone taking an opposite view would say, look, European way of life is also open and democratic. And you don't get as much clash. You do get a clash, but not as much clash between the Middle East and Western European countries. In fact, you get a lot of courting from both ends. So maybe the U.S. is doing something wrong. Like, what would we say to someone?
Right. Well, I would say, look at Europe and what's happening now on the streets of Europe and what's happening in European parliaments. They're kowtowing to extreme Islamist actors in their countries because they realized that they didn't deal with the problem when it was in the Middle East, but they let the Middle East come to Europe. The amount of instances of sexual abuse in Germany, open rape nights in Cologne, which took place only a few years ago. The amount of involvement of courts, which serve as parallel judicial entities in the United Kingdom, hundreds of Sharia courts, which enforce their own laws, ignoring the mandate of the crown and the ability to work there. The identity by France and the French government that the Muslim Brotherhood is trying to influence French society from within. I would say to them, if you don't want to have what happens repeat itself in the United States, which was what has already happened in Europe, you better double down on your focus in the Middle East. Because it's okay to say that culture and the way that we expect our lives to be led and our governments to be the referee of those livelihoods is okay for us to be American. In Europe, it's not okay to be European anymore.
Although again, like I just got back from Europe, yeah. And honestly, I asked many Jews that I met there, what do you see for the future in France? And everyone said somewhere between, we got 10 to 20 more years. And then I asked, what's next? And they, you know, depending on their level of faith or belief, would say, God knows, Hashem Yishmo, you know, whatever. Yeah. But an alternative would say, look, it's all through democratic process, right? It's like, if we hold dear this idea of democracy, one person, one vote, the ideas that win out are the ones that get, you know, the best ideas, or at least the most popular ideas, as long as it's not done violently, what is the problem?
And that's exactly why we started that project that I mentioned earlier in our conversation, about looking at the influence of nonviolent Islamists on Western society. Because first it starts as accepting refugee admissions. Like, let's look at Germany, for example. They had a huge labor shortage in the 1960s and signed an agreement with Turkey to allow millions of Turks into Germany, who eventually became citizens. And those Turks, they're German. They identify as German first. But that spirit of refugee admissions, not from needing laborers, but from bringing more people in, including millions of Syrian refugees that came in after the civil war started in 2011, led to some individuals who brought their ideas with them and didn't want to turn and become German and become identifying with a German identity. They brought their anti-Semitism that they learned from the Assad regime there. They brought their anti-feminist ideologies. They brought their chauvinist characteristics. They said, we are going to live here, we are going to make money here, but we're not going to change and we're not going to respect the ways of life. That we, when you become a citizen of the United States, you have to understand basic precepts of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. There's expectation that you'll speak English. They're not learning German. They're living in their cantons in what are otherwise called no-go zones. And they're trying to recreate the area that they left just on German soil. And European politicians have realized this now. The Socialist Party in Denmark, which is a left-wing party, ran on an issue of being anti-immigration in the last elections. The first time that a left-wing party was anti-immigrant. And it wasn't because they have negative feelings about refugees, but they've seen how Danish society has changed because of the admission of so many people coming into the country. Same thing with Sweden. If you go to Malmo now, you'll see that most of the streets are ruled by gangs of individuals who came from Middle East and North African countries. Italy recognizes it as a problem. Greece recognizes it as an issue. Spain now has created a fortified wall along the Strait of Gibraltar and the two islands that they control off the coast of Morocco, because they realize that it's not just letting in people who eventually will become Spanish citizens and then vote not for what a majority of Spaniards consider to be Spanish way of life, and forget about Catalonia and the Basques and everything else, but they're bringing their identities, they're not absorbing into society, and eventually that shift that democracy allows is those who believe in Islamist ways of thought using democracy as a vehicle to then bring the Sharia to Europe, rather than using democracy as something which is to batten down and adopt democratic values. Democracy's fine, so long as you're using it to be democratic, not using it as a vehicle to bring undemocratic ideas into your society.
And, you know, and the history of the U.S., I mean, this is the history of many democracies, but especially in the U.S., has had waves of immigration. It was the Irish, it was the German, it was the Jews, it was the Chinese in the late 19th century, which then brought with them waves of panic or distress.
Right.
The country's changing. I mean, now we're dealing with South American immigration. often that worry was overstated. Is this the case now, or how is this different?
No, I think that, let's leave the United States on the side for a second, look at Europe. When you try to placate an immigrant population and you go to the line of start ignoring what you consider to be a norm for your society, for instance, allowing certain imams to come to the United Kingdom. And the UK didn't recognize that some of these imams, where many ISIS members actually, members grew up, and then went to Syria to go fight with ISIS. There's tens of thousands of foreign individuals now in Syria in holding camps led by the Kurds that have European passports. And Europe doesn't want to let them back in. I'm not focused on them not letting them back in. I'm focusing on how they got radicalized in the first place and why some of these mosques in the UK were allowed to run without any restrictions, without any monitoring, without any clamping down on the sermons that their preachers gave them, saying, you might be in the UK, but the English are your enemy. That's not acceptable in the United States. And yeah, there's freedom of speech here, but the second that you go from speaking about something to then material supporting somebody, you're going to end up in federal prison. So the U.S. is ahead of the game insofar as it expects that people who come to this country become Americans and embrace the American way of life while still honoring and respecting and identifying with their unique cultural and religious and social norms that they may have grown up on. But there's an expectation that you're going to salute the flag, that you're going to pledge allegiance, that you're going to have your oath that you give when you become a citizen of this country. There's a process to be able to do that. And every generation that you mentioned, there may have been a great fear, but eventually they became absorbed into the United States. But in Europe, there's no absorption process. There's just recreating the land from which they came and asking the governing authorities out of political correctness, or, dear God, you're accused of being an Islamophobe or xenophobic, to not have them ask you to become European. And that's the real fissure between the two areas. In the U.S., there's the expectation they become American. And the law enforces that. In Europe, it's the exact opposite.
And how do you create that balance, right? Because clearly, it seems like you're clearly motivated by upholding American democracy and American values. At some point when every democracy must protect itself, and so it doesn't, you know, fall from within. But at some point, the protections become so severe that the protections themselves start unraveling the democracy. So what, in your opinion, what is the balance between letting refugees in, letting immigrants in, absorbing them into society while also keeping away the danger?
Right. So I think that it's okay as part of American immigration for there to be vetting, not based on religion, not based on sex, not based on the color of your skin, but based on your beliefs. My wife was born in Israel. She became an American citizen through a naturalization process. She was on a green card when she moved here and eventually became a citizen. And as part of that, she had to take a course on what it means to be an American. You have to learn the presidents. You have to learn how the Congress works, how the Constitution works. But there's a missing element there. It's one thing to have knowledge. It's another thing to adopt that knowledge and make it part of your life. So on the immigration form, they ask you, are you a member of the Communist Party? Are you a Nazi? Have you ever been involved with the violent overthrow of your home government? Things which, you know, are fair questions to ask if you're asking to become an American. What's missing there is whether you believe in what I think a majority, if not most Americans, believe are American ideas. Do you believe in the separation of church and state, or in this case, mosque and state? Do you believe that everyone is entitled to equal rights? Do you believe that the government comes first before your religion, or at least that they're equal, on equal footing? Do you believe in the separation of powers, the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive branch? And those are things which I think might do a good job at least be able to get someone on record so that if they ever engage in behavior, which is opposite of those questions, then it would give you the case to be able to take their citizenship away. And I think it's okay to expect people to believe in the ideas of America, but also to expect them to at least respect other Americans who engage in that.
Interesting. So before we get to the Middle East itself, because we are talking about the effect of the Middle East in the US.
Right.
Let's talk about Campus Watch.
Sure.
So you've mentioned it before just in passing, but explain what was the need for, what is Campus Watch and what was the need for creating Campus Watch?
Sure. So right after 9/11, there were, for lack of a better word, Al-Qaeda apologists who started coming out of the academic woodwork that the U.S.'s intervention in Afghanistan would lead to a collapse of the Middle East, that it wasn't justified, that these terrorists who sought to strike at the heart of American economy and American military power, the 9/11 on the Twin Towers and then at the Pentagon, weren't justified in their actions, but America's response should be limited. And then when the talk around Iraq started coming out of whether the U.S. should intervene there, the same kind of rhetoric would go forward. Iraq is a colonialist engagement by the United States seeking to take over the Middle East. But what I think was really the starting point was how academics engaged on the Israel-Palestinian conversation or the wider Israel-Arab conversation. Efforts at Columbia University to outlaw the speaking of Hebrew because it was considered to be a colonialist language. The idea that Israelis weren't entitled to equal rights and that professors at American universities were saying they should go back to Europe because this was this sort of anti-academe position where they were using academia to justify the actions of people who were illiberal and against American values. So when we saw enough professors that were saying this, I think we came to the point. I was a senior in high school when this took place. I was a freshman in college at American University in D.C. When you started having the curricula, the syllabi, the material that you were learning in school, which was basically teaching you to be anti-American as related to Middle East and Islamic studies programs. They were teaching their version of what it was and only their version rather than allowing diverse perspectives in the classroom. So instead of bringing in an Israeli speaker who would talk about the benefits of growing Tel Aviv's tech economy, they would only have Palestinians talking about the BDS movement. This is where folks like Omar Barghouti got his start. This is where other professors, many of whom are now known as sort of the scions of anti-Israel thought on American campuses and anti-American involvement in the Middle East. And there was no body which was saying that there is this unipolar worldview. There is this uniformity of opinion in Middle East and Islamic studies programs. And they wouldn't keep their opinions in the classroom. Or rather, they wouldn't keep their opinions outside of the classroom. They would come into the classroom, which was destructive to the next generation of American academics, especially those that wanted to focus on Middle East policy. They weren't getting the whole worldview. They were only getting one side. So when we started calling this out, it started off just as a series of articles on presentations at like the Alawite Center for Christian Muslim Understanding at Georgetown University, UCLA's Middle East Studies program. And we found out that they were getting federal funding to be able to give these views. So imagine a federally funded boycott, divestment, and sanctions curriculum that didn't offer anything positive about Israel or anything on the other side of that. And these professors then would take their adherents in class and they would eventually go beyond the classroom and use their academic positions and their perches in the ivory tower of Middle East studies to justify actions by others who were criticizing the U.S.'s actions and Israel's actions in the Middle East. So you would have an article written by a professor in the New York Times saying, this is apartheid. You would have another professor saying in the Chicago Sun Tribune, what's happening is genocide. Everything that you're hearing since October 7th has been the same lip service and the same accusations that academics have been making for decades, and no one ever called them out on it until Campus Watch was started. And now we see these very same professors being those who are leading the efforts to exclude Jews from campus, to try to demonize Israelis who are trying to get an education, and then justifying actions like Hamas and celebrating. We had professors celebrating the October 7th massacre on their social media only hours after it took place. But they try to say that they're justified in doing so because they have tenure. So that's why Campus Watch was created. And that's why it's more important than ever today, at least from the professorial point of view, in calling them out and their ridiculous statements.
And what would you say to the critics of Campus Watch? And I should say that I have used the work of Campus Watch as a resource to understand the history of many of these professors. But you know, you do have your critics that say that this is McCarthy-esque, that you are blocking any legitimate criticism of U.S. foreign policy of Israel. What's your response to the critics?
Your work should speak for itself. If it's something that could be vetted in a peer-reviewed process by those who don't just hold your same worldview, then you should feel okay with it. See, the same opportunity to give your viewpoints out in the classroom as you disallow others from. You cancel tenure, you cancel professors, you try to make it a point to get the administrations behind you, you cry when donors cut your grants because they don't agree with your view. If you don't like what's happening, maybe you shouldn't be espousing these worldviews. And if you want to be able to find a safe space to be able to have these views, at least invite other professors in to challenge you so an outside body like Campus Watch doesn't have to exist because you've decided to hijack your department and make it only reflective of the way in which you see the world rather than the way others might see it outside your little four-foot world inside your Middle East Studies department.
And what would be your ideal Middle Eastern Studies department?
Well, I think if we take people, you know, if we have somebody like Martin Kramer, who was at the Shalem Center, and he wrote the book, The Ivory Tower, How Middle East Studies Have Been Corrupted in America.
Ivory Tower on Sand. Yeah, it's a great book.
Yeah, he was an editor of our publication, Middle East Quarterly, around the time that this was published. And if he was then invited to share the same departmental headquarters with Rashid Khalidi, I can imagine that might lead to some fireworks, but at least you'd be getting two different views of this. And the rewards and the journals and the peer-reviewed publications that are coming out, like the Journal of Palestine Studies, I can imagine one time that there's been a professor who has at least philo-Semitic views being able to publish a piece in that publication. So if you want to be able to have the ideal Middle East Studies department, have people from all walks of life, all views of the Middle East, rather than just giving tenure and acceptance to the professors who share the way you see the world.
So basically, it sounds like the issue is not necessarily each individual professor and their views. Well, of course, there are some extreme cases, but more of the aggregate of it, we only get these certain professors that are certain biases and they don't allow, for lack of a better word, biases on the other side that will cancel them out.
Right. Diversity is based upon a plethora of opinion, not just unanimity of one opinion. And I think that whilst there are very, very good Middle East studies professors out there who really, like I said before, call balls and strikes on certain issues, there is severely lacking a training program to be able to bring those middle-of-the-road professors and those who might have divergent views outside of Israel, where there's a very strong Middle East studies program, programs at different universities there. But there's really no incentive for people to go into academia to become Middle East studies professors if their opinions don't mesh with those who are already in power. So you have a lack of a well of talent because they find other professions to go into. But there's actually a bigger problem here rather than just the professoriate, if you want to call it that. It's the universities where these professors who have anti-American and anti-Israel views are headquartered, are feeder programs for those who are involved in Middle East policy. If you look at Georgetown School of Foreign Service and the Alawit Center, a report that Middle East Forum is about to issue, another one that the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy under Charles Small just came out with, shows that the Middle East Studies programs are feeding into the CIA, into the State Department, into the Foreign Service, into foreign policy analyst positions on Capitol Hill. And who's underwriting them? The Qataris. They have become a vehicle, not just for pernicious scholarship, but they have become a vehicle for the next generation of American foreign policymakers who are going to share those worldviews. And in the end, it'll be more dangerous for Americans. And beyond that, it's being funded by those who want to see a weak America in the Middle East, who want to handicap the ability for foreign policymakers to get all perspectives. And it's really hurting our national interest, not just hurting the university.
So let's zoom into the Middle East.
Sure.
Let's zoom in. And you mentioned Qatar. So let's start with Qatar.
Yeah.
What should Americans understand about Qatar?
So Qatar is the eighth emirate that never joined the UAE. It's the ultimate underdog who sees himself as an underdog, but in fact, one of the most powerful nations in the Middle East, if not the wealthiest amongst all of them, at least on a per capita basis. Qatar from the 70s was seen as a country with sort of the odd man out. They adopted a radical Wahhabist Muslim Brotherhood type of Islam for their state religion. The joke was that Warren Christopher made, the former U.S. Secretary of State, after the Soviet War ended, after the Soviet Union ended and the Cold War ended, what are the two most powerful countries on earth? He said the United States and Qatar. The reason being that everything that the Qataris would need to have a population then of only a few hundred thousand people, only today there's 320,000, 330,000 Qatari citizens, they used to basically take two sides of any problem, to insert themselves in the middle, and then to try to have both sides fight off of each other, finding the Qataris as the solution, often the problems that they created.
But what's their interest? Why would they ever, a tiny country in the middle of nowhere?
It's the Middle East Napoleonic complex. Because they're a tiny country in the middle of nowhere, with control of one of the most bountiful natural gas reserves in the forest field, which is off their coast, and also some other oil and hydrocarbon assets, they've always seen themselves as trying to punch above their weight with their bigger, more, not wealthy, but stronger Arab neighbors. So there was a story during the Gulf War when there was the Arab Legion, which was trying to be the first across the Saudi desert into Iraq after the U.S. and the U.N. coalition decided to start the Gulf War, that the Qataris fired on a Saudi tank so they could eliminate the treads to be able to claim they were the first to intervene in Iraq. And the same thing happened in the 90s. They had Al Jazeera as a mouthpiece to foment Arab revolt and Islamist thought throughout the Middle East because they didn't like what state media was saying about the Qataris in other countries. Come 9/11, they hosted Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and gave him a passport to be able to flee. This is the architect of the 9/11 attacks because they saw him as being useful until the attack took place. They also have tried to underwrite revolts throughout the Middle East. They're underwriting the Turkish economy right now. They're the main supplier of foreign currency into Iran, banking for them, and also sharing half of whatever is coming from the forest fields that they share with the Iranians. But the big thing about the Qataris that no one really seems to grasp is how they are able to get away with every single action that they take part in. Funding ISIS, funding Jabhat al-Nusra, providing haven for al-Qaeda, paying off Hezbollah, trying to cause revolutions. And they successfully did in the first few years of the Arab Spring against U.S. allies and other countries which were ostensibly in the U.S.'s, not pocket, but in our sphere of influence. And I think as it relates to Qatar and Israel, they see Israel as the one country that maybe up until a few months ago, they couldn't control because of the fact that it's not Islamic, that Israel would do what was best for foreign policy. And Israel was always the top U.S. ally in the Middle East. And I think still is to a certain extent today. The Qataris saw Israel as sort of a mole on their back. They just had to find a way to excise and get rid of. And they went so far as to not just create the problem, Hamas, by providing them refuge and money, but they were able to convince the Israelis to be able to do it in the way that they would fund Hamas to the tunes of billions of dollars over 11 years. And even today, if you want to try to release Israelis from captivity in Gaza, you have to go to Doha. They have been able to cement themselves in every Middle East conflict and always come out on top. Even when the Gulf Cooperation Council countries boycotted them and gave them 18 conditions to get their behavior straight, they were able to survive that by not just buying American politicians. Why do you think Bob Menendez is in jail right now? One of the reasons is he took a Qatari bribe. The same thing with members of European Parliament. There's six different prosecutions right now because the Qataris try to buy them off to get favorable gas rights. They even bought the World Cup in 2022 by bribing 10 of the 14 members of the selection committee. They distribute their resources. They know if they can't get something, they'll pay a higher price to buy it. And they're able to get every single thing that they try to have access to because they have perfected the game of inside influence.
But wouldn't a counterpoint would be, look, the U.S. has one of the biggest air bases in the Middle East in Qatar.
That the Qataris pay for.
But if the U.S. Air Force, if it's good enough for the U.S. Air Force, then who are we to complain about what Qatar is doing in other countries?
Right. It's because the actions that they do in countries elsewhere other than Qatar end up leading to Americans dying in those countries or end up leading to the American people being less safe here in the United States. We end up in situations where our politics are being unduly influenced by the same group of people who are hosting our airmen. And there's also other options beyond Al Udeid Air Force Base outside of Doha. The Emiratis have made an offer. Bahrain has made an offer. The Saudis even are open to the idea of the U.S. stationing air power there. And the Saudis aren't trying to disrupt our way of life here. Maybe they were 20 years ago. but they've since reformed. The Emiratis are our closest ally in intelligence in the Middle East besides Israel, and Bahrain is trying to also do the same thing. So there's other options with groups that would be willing to pay the same way that the Qataris are paying, but at the same time, not bringing all the baggage that comes with it. So I think if you are the chief budget officer, that's a position that exists, but if you're the officer responsible for Air Force budgeting at CENTCOM, at Central Command, and you see that the Qataris are underwriting your airbase to the tune of billions of dollars a year and expanding your barracks and giving you the best facilities, you're going to say, you know what? I don't have to contribute to my budget and ask the Congress for more money or go to the top Pentagon undersecretary responsible for management and budget. The Qataris will pay for that. It's real easy out. But they're not taking into consideration the whole multiplex of issues which deal with the ways in which the Qataris are otherwise trying to influence the United States. I mean, even now, with the $1.2 trillion in deals that were signed in Doha on President Trump's last visit there, one dealt with quantum computing. Now, we rely on encrypted messaging applications as civilians, right, to be able to try to make sure the government's not spying on us. There's also military applications to that, where the military has even better cryptography and encryption methods. Quantum computing is the last phase of being able to break encrypted communications. And now the Qataris, who have deep relations with the Chinese, deep relations with the Russians, very solid relationships with the Iranians, they've even been caught spying, hacking into 1,500 email addresses on American soil, but were able to get away with it because of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. You are now going to give them the best access to American quantum engineering? It's suicide. So I think people have to be more aware of this. They have to wake up to it. We haven't even talked about what they've done to the American Jewish community. That's a whole other lobbying trick that they try to pull on us between 2017 and today. But the Qataris are, at the end of the day, nefarious actor who are a threat to American national interests, not just in the Middle East, but here at home. And they should be dealt with as such. And every ploy they have has to be unpeeled like an onion, get to the core of it, and decore it so that they can't keep on doing what they're doing.
So now let's move to the second biggest player in the region, which is Iran. What should Americans know about Iran?
So a few things. Number one, the Iranian people are with America. 80% in polling, which can be reliably seen. Phone calls going into the country, online. Maybe there's a margin of error, 5 or 6 points either way, the 74 to 86%. But the majority of the Iranian people, the supermajority of the Iranian people, are not happy with the regime and want to see it go. So the first thing is the Iranians don't want the U.S. to overthrow the regime. They themselves want to remove it. The second thing is that Iran is weak now, but continued negotiations and diplomacy with Iran must have an endpoint as much as it has a start point. President Trump gave the Iranians 60 days to agree in some fashion to remove their enrichment capacity from Iranian soil, not just to lower it down to a 3.14% degree, which would be enough for civilian energy, but to completely remove uranium enrichment and the potential to get plutonium so that they don't have any possibility of getting a nuclear program. The third thing is that you can get change in Iran without sending American soldiers there or using American air power to make change there. There's a process that was developed at the Reichman University in Herzliya, Israel, called tailored deterrence. The idea is instead of sanctioning an entire country, you go after their leadership, not through assassination, not through kinetic action, but through non-kinetic coercion. That the policy of the United States can be to make sure that the mullahs wake up every day having a really, really bad day to look forward to, rather than worrying about American aircraft overhead trying to bomb them. So there's a people who want to be free. There's a situation which merits the removal of all nuclear capabilities. And there are methods which can be used that can influence Iran without having to lose American lives as a result of that. If Americans know those three things, they can ask the members of Congress and the executive branch to pursue that and have a policy which walks the fine line between military intervention and disengagement and giving the Iranians what they want. And if they do that, then I think that you'll see a better Iran, one like it was before 1979 when it was an ally of Israel, it was an ally of the United States. It's just a matter of having the right policy. And we're not there yet, but we're getting in the right direction.
So we got Qatar, and it's basically buying its way in the world. We got Iran with the IRGC and the mullahs
right.
trying to force their way in the world. Then we have the third superpower vying for superpower yeah. in the Middle East, which is probably the most complicated one because it's, at least on paper, nominally a democracy. It's a NATO member. And of course, I'm talking about Turkey.
Right.
So what do we need to know about Turkey?
Turkey is that guy, Carl, on your street that you go to with a problem, but you never realize the price you're going to have to pay until you have the problem fixed. Turkey, over the last 23 years, since the ascent of Recep Tayyip Erdogan in 2002 to be the prime minister and then the president of the country, has moved away from NATO. They've moved away from Europe. They've moved away from the United States and largely into the hands of Russia and China. There's a few examples just in the past month or two. Most of the weapons that Pakistan used against India in the last border flare-up that took place in Kashmir over water rights was Turkish weaponry. Financed by the Qataris, engineered and designed by the Turks, launched by the Pakistanis. Most of the inhibition of rights which have taken place in Turkey have been because of Erdogan. First, he went for people within his own party with the division of the Gulenist movement. Then he went for the judiciary. Then he arrested over 30 mayors of Kurdish-majority towns in the eastern part of the country. And then he went against his main opposition party a few months ago by arresting İmamoğlu, the mayor of Istanbul, who was going to run as president, as a presidential candidate against him in the upcoming Turkish presidential elections. And Erdogan has spent time also grooming his potential successor, either his son-in-law or the foreign minister who used to be the head of the Turkish intelligence agency, the MIT. Erdogan is not stopping within his borders. Now he is expanding his neo-Ottoman project by going and trying to take over Syria and making it a jihadi statelet of the Turkish government. Every Syrian minister has a Turkish minder who is with him in every decision and every meeting that they're making. The Turkish Navy is deploying its assets off the Syrian coast. The Turkish Air Force is trying to take over Syrian airspace so that now Syria will have the Turkish Air Force protecting its airspace right on the border with Israel. It has not allowed the United States to use its bases in Turkey, like Incirlik, where the U.S. has nuclear weapons stationed in Turkey. And it's part of our nuclear deterrent against Russia. In fact, Erdogan has invited Russia in to build a nuclear reactor on the Black Sea and has invited Russian air defenses to be part of that nuclear reactor's air defense system, which if the United States was to give F-35, or one of our most advanced fighter jets, to the Turkish Air Force, the Russians would use the F-35s flying over Turkish airspace as a way to try to figure out its stealth technologies, thereby making the U.S. weaker vis-a-vis our competitive advantage that we have over Russia right now. Every action that Turkey is taking is against U.S. policy interests. In the short term, they may provide a quick fix, some duct tape on the problem, but at the end of the day, it ends up hemorrhaging and it'll cause much greater problems, not just for the United States, but also for Europe. That was the issue that we have with the Syrian refugees flowing into Europe by way of Erdogan not having a good border guard. He used it kind of as a spigot. He would turn on the refugee problem when he wanted something from Europe, and as soon as he got it, he would turn it off. And then a year later, there would be more refugees, and there would be less once the Europeans paid cadence to what he wanted.
And then we get to the final, probably the joker.
Yeah.
And that's Syria.
Right.
The country, the area with the biggest question mark above it. And obviously, you know, by the time this episode comes out, things change very quickly in the Middle East, and in, especially in Syria. But what is the long run view? What do we need to know about Syria? And I guess the biggest question is, can jihadists become democratic leaders?
I don't think jihadists can become democratic leaders. But I think jihadists can use democracy of sort of as a vanity cover to be able to get their true means to be able to be present in the state known as Syria, which I think might eventually become the Islamic Republic of Syria. A few things you have to know. The president, al-Jalani, does not control the entire country. He only controls a narrow cordon between Damascus and Idlib, which is sort of like a reverse L, going from the sea at the north of the Turkish-Syrian border down to the capital. Anywhere outside isn't under his control. Areas that are under his control, and these are Turkish foreign jihadis who are not Syrian citizens, tens of thousands of fighters who want to stay in Syria but are not of Syrian origin control the expanse from the Euphrates River to the Mediterranean coast. These are the massacres that took place in Tartus and Latakia. The Alawi, this is the ethnic religious background that Assad came from, when 800 Alawis were massacred, that was done by foreign jihadis that the Turks back. Then you have the south of Syria, which is a mix of both Sunni Arabs and Druze. The Sunni Arabs that are in the southeast corner of the country are largely allied with the United States, and those who are now affiliated with the Druze are under an Israeli protectorate. The biggest opposition to Jilani, and I think the biggest hope for Syria, is the SDF, or the Syrian Democratic Forces, which constitute over 100,000 Kurdish fighters, which are in the area of the country, which is in the northeast. Those are under U.S. patronage. They are always at odds with the Turks. The Turks would like nothing better than to ethnically cleanse all the Kurds from the Syrian Turkish border. And if Jilani wants to be able to have not just a secure and stable and safe Syria, but one in which represents and respects all of its minorities, there's 17 different ethnic groups that constitute Syrian governance. He has to be able to find a deal with the Druze, a deal with the Kurds, and something to make sure the Alawis aren't being massacred every other Sunday. Jilani's government right now, his foreign minister, is negotiating with Israel and Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is overseeing negotiations for the security situation in the south of Syria. So Israel has its security needs met, and so that Jilani can extend sovereignty to the south of the country. Beyond that, you also have negotiations between the Kurds and Jilani. They've reached an agreement, but it hasn't been implemented yet. And I think that you also have to worry about the Russians, who still have an airbase, still have a naval base, and maybe extend the rights to allow them to keep Hamamim and Tartus, which are the two main assets the Russians have there. But if Erdogan has his way, he will turn Syria into a Turkish statelet, the very same way that he was able to turn the Turkish Republic of Cyprus into that over the last 20 years. If it goes in that direction, you have what to worry about.
I think a lot of people listening in or watching this will be rightfully feeling overwhelmed right now. Just by the sheer amount of information. So I guess the two questions that we'll have to end with is, one, where can people educate themselves more about everything we've talked about, both in terms of internally what's happening in the US and in Europe, but also what's happening in the Middle East in these four countries and in other countries? So that's the first question. The second question is, once they have the information, what can they do?
Sure. So the Middle East Forum, as a forum, exists as a place for different types of thought on Middle Eastern issues, not just those affecting the United States, but affecting Middle East countries writ large. So if you want to go to meforum.org, every day there's new material on there, new analysis, new talking points, a 4,000-word article distilled into a tweet, following us on social media or other places. But it's not enough to just be educated about the Middle East issues. You can also act, which is why we have our Action Center. So if you go to meforum.org/action, at any given time, there's 20 to 25 things that people can do to have a direct impact on these issues. And it's not just writing a letter to your member of Congress or putting something on social media, sharing a video. There's other ideas for campaigns that you can do in your own community. So if the Qataris are investing in Arkansas State University or Arizona State University, you can reach out to the Board of Governors at those two places. In terms of local politics, there's many efforts right now to try to bring the Israel-Arab conversation or Israeli-Palestinian conversation to school boards. If you're not happy with the curriculum that they're teaching in K-12, download our K-12 packet and understand what you can do to try to make a little bit of a difference at a school board conversation when they have open discussion at the end of every meeting. Or even if you're a major shareholder in a company and you see that your company that you're involved with, even you might even just be a retiree and you have one share, is about to do business with a Qatari investment fund, write a letter, attend a shareholder meeting, become a stakeholder and an activist in the area where you have influence. Whether you're just a stay-at-home mom and you've got four kids and you're just watching the news and you have some extra time to put out a tweet, or you're a major CEO of a company and you have some heft in your industry, there's a way in which you can help make America safer in the Middle East and promote responsible Middle East policy rather than ignoring the problem or, on the other hand, contributing to it.
And I should also add that there's, if you go on your website on Middle East Forum, you have a legislator tab
right,
where it's very informative because you can see all the different laws that are either being considered or have recently passed that relate specifically to U.S. interests in the Middle East and in the U.S. as concerning, for example, Qatari money. And educate yourself.
No, 435 members of Congress. We have all of their records, 100 members of the Senate. You can look at all their positions too. Everything's available. We try to make it really easy for people to be able to access. And all of our staff are available all the time. We don't work at the Middle East Forum because you want a 9-to-5 job. You do this because you believe in the mission. And I'm really proud of the people we have working with us too, because they don't just talk about this. They live this and they work this. So
Greg, before we end, we're going to do what we call the Here I Am lightning round, just a series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer, just the first thing that comes to mind. Greg Roman, what is one thing people don't know about you?
That I am a wrestling coach.
You look like one.
Yeah.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That we have a horrible sense of style.
Okay. What is your favorite curse? In different languages.
Yeah, Ahabel.
Like it's a, you moron.
Yeah.
When was the last time you cried?
Probably last week. My father was put into the intensive care unit in a hospital down in Trenton. So that was pretty rough.
How's he doing?
Getting a little bit better.
We'll keep him in our thoughts. If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
This is kind of a cop-out, but probably Ben-Gurion. Or maybe if I really could do it, I'd invite Menachem Begin and Ben-Gurion at the same time and see how that conversation went.
That's going to be a fireworks. You'd rather have Michael Kramer and Rashid Khalidi. What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Probably Lag BaOmer. I love the bonfires.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Probably Yom Kippur.
When do you feel safest?
When I'm with my kids.
When do you feel least safe?
Probably when I'm flying over Ben Gurion Airport and there's a Houthi missile coming in.
What gives you hope?
That the Israeli electorate has moved to a way that they recognize that they have to be able to promote Israel's interests first and not necessarily worry about what the rest of the world is saying about them.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world. Where would you want listeners to donate to?
Well, if I didn't say Middle East Forum, because we have an Israel office, I'd probably say United Hatzalah.
Where can people find a Middle East Forum?
You can find us in a few places. On our website at meforum, forum.org. You can follow us on Instagram at meforum, on X at meforum. We also have all of our other projects outlets, which are easily accessible there.
Well, I urge people to go and educate themselves more about the Middle East. It has been probably one of the most influential geographic areas in the past 20 years, and I expect that to remain so in the coming 20 years.
Thank you, Shai.
And thank you for coming here, and here I am with Greg Roman.
Thank you.
Hi. I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."